The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
Good morning and welcome to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting from the University of California campus in Irvine, streaming on the web at kuci.org and always available via podcast. We are on iTunes under Writers on Writing. We're on Stitcher and other podcast platforms. I'm your host for the hour, Marie Stone, and we are doing what we do each and every week, which is chat with authors about their books, their process, their craft, how they're working and focusing and thinking during these kind of weird days. Jess Walter is my guest for the hour. His latest novel is The Cold Millions. I should mention that while this interview is airing in October, it was recorded on September 8th. And I bring that up, A, because it's appropriate that we're talking about this book just after Labor Day, which will become clear for some reasons pretty soon. But more important, I feel like COVID time and 2020 time have new meaning these days, and it's hard for me to even picture what October and November are going to look like. So if anything sounds dated or out of time, know that we are still back at the beginning of September. A former National Book Award finalist and winner of the Edgar Allan Poe Award, Jess Walter is the author now of 7 novels, 1 book of short stories, and 1 nonfiction book. His work has been translated into 32 languages, and his fiction has been selected 3 times for Best American Short Stories, as well as the Pushcart Prize and Best American Non-Required Reading. His stories and essays and journalism have appeared in Harper's, Esquire, Playboy, McSweeney's, Tin House, on and on. He's been on the show 3 times in the past for We Live in Water, Beautiful Ruins, and The Financial Lives of the Poets. He's also been a part of our writer's salon, so you can find all those past interviews with Barbara up on our site. We would be here the full hour if I recounted all of Jess's awards, but last night I had a debate with my husband about whether I'd rather be a finalist for the Pulitzer or a Terry Gross Fresh Air Novel of the Year or a President Barack Obama Favorite Book of the Year. And then I realized he got each of those accolades for 3 separate books, and I'm confident the accolades are going to keep pouring down for this latest one, which we're talking about today. Cold Millions is published by HarperCollins. It will drive a lot of our discussion this morning. Jess, welcome back.
Thanks, Marie. It's so good to be with you again, as close as we can be.
In these weird times, right. Well, I was just saying before we went on, it's the benefit of this is getting a sneak peek into all of these writers' offices and through Zoom. So that, you know, I'm trying to look for the silver linings these days. But
I'm always afraid people are going to find that one terrible book on my bookshelves, like the like when they grab your phone and find the song you don't want anybody to hear, you know, on your iTunes.
No such thing as a terrible book. That's what I say.
That's true.
So whenever I pick up one of your books, I have this Forrest Gump sort of experience of feeling like they're all like a box of every favorite kind of chocolate, but I never quite know what I'm going to get. But I know it's always going to be chocolate. And turns out with this one, more amazing chocolate. But I was wondering, before we dive into this one, now that you've got 7 books and I have no idea how many short stories, if you sort of look across all of these different time periods, these different genres, if you see sort of a uniting principle, or if it's just kind of the sum of parts of an interesting mind with all of its various rooms?
Wow, it's like such a good question. I do think that I look across them and see patterns emerging, but it's mostly in the voice and tone, I guess. I'm a big believer that the story tells you what it wants to be. I'm not writing a 9-part history of growing up in Spokane Valley. Some, you know, auto fiction. I really get engaged by some topic and some place. And once I find the voice, it almost emerges from that. But I do think that what I've found in my voice is a kind of wistful sense of humor that I think runs over the top of each of them, and a sort of humanism, a desire for people to be better, to treat each other better, to be kinder. I just think that that's the thing that I see emerging and that I find is something I always wanted to do as a storyteller. And I think that if confidence leads you anywhere after 7 novels and a book of short stories and a nonfiction book, it's in that direction towards seeing what it is you want the work to aspire to. And for me, that is, you know, a better state of humanity, even if it's just represented with these really small lives that you write about.
So much of your work has that sense of humor. I get the sense you got that from your dad.
I did. I mean, both my parents had, my mother was very sweet and earnest, died young, and my dad is a bit of a raconteur. So I do think I feel sometimes like, when you look at a baby and you say he has her eyes and his chin, and, you know, I feel very much like appreciative that I got those two things from, you know, from parents who had no idea they were raising an author. I'm not sure what they thought they were raising, but I feel like they've served me well in these books.
Yeah. Well, the other thing that shows through in every single one is how clearly you just seem like you're having so much fun. I mean, you know, it seems like you're in it for yourself as much as you're in it for the reader. You know, you're in it to surprise yourself, and you're in it to make yourself laugh, and you're in it maybe to make yourself cry.
I think that's the best observation. I'm always surprised how many writers, I mean, it's a labor for all of us. It's not always fun, but I do aspire to have fun. And it's funny, we call it work. I'm at work, I'm going to work, are you working on your novel? And musicians don't call it that. They call it play. They go to the bar and they play. They get up in the morning and they go to their studio and they play. And I always try to remind myself to play, to riff, to get on the guitar and just play some chords until something comes of it. And Thinking of my work like a musician thinks of theirs for me was just a great way to keep that the love of writing that we get reading other writers. You know, we have no problem reading other writers and seeing the fun they're having, but for some reason, and I know the reason, it's hard work, you know, that we can lose that in ourselves.
I am so glad you brought up this issue of work versus play, because I just recently sort of reframed that in my own head. And, you know, when you think about it as play, A, it makes it more fun. B, it takes sort of the pressure off, right? Well, if I'm just playing, the stakes aren't that high and you can take a few more risks or something. So I'm really glad you said that, because it's just, I think the stories we tell ourselves about our work or our play really kind of can put the brakes on what we're working on. So that's a great way to look at it.
So the rest of our lives is work. And not that this isn't. I mean, there were points when I thought this novel's going to destroy me. But as they all do, I mean, finishing a novel is just, you know, really is, there's a physical part of it that you just can't get around. But the writing itself, these bursts of voices that you get to inhabit, and even just the joy of telling a story, you know, that I'll be reading someone else's book and a great surprise will come. And I try to allow myself to enjoy those surprises of diction or of lyricism or of plot as much as when I'm reading.
Yeah. So you talk a lot about how you tack back and forth between novels set close to home and novels set at a distance. And so it was time to come home for this one. So I'd love for you to kind of set the stage for The Cold Millions and take us into it, and then that'll kind of establish the groundwork for us.
Yeah, The Cold Millions is set in this period of history that I've always been fascinated by, in part because I live in Spokane, Washington, which is a city that sort of peaked and thrived at the end of the Gilded Age. And so I wanted to write about 1909, when Spokane was doubling every 6 or 7 years and still had the sort of energy of an old West Klondike town, brothels and murders on the street, but also was becoming a modern city. It was over 100,000 people and was a vital railway. And it started to seem to me like Deadwood, but with 100,000 people in it. And that that idea of trying to show the way civilization comes into a place, what we call civilization, at the expense of tribes, at the expense of character sometimes, that just really interested me. The novel is about two itinerant workers, two hobos named Rye and Gig Dolan, brothers who are an adventuring pair who find themselves in Spokane when the industrial workers of the world, the IWW, this nascent labor union, is having free speech riots or free speech protests on the streets of Spokane. And it turned into riots and into police brutality and into really one of the uses of nonviolent protest in the United States. And so it started for me as a way to write about a vibrant past, write almost with the style of a Western set in this 1909 world. And it felt like such undiscovered territory there. There were horses and cars sharing the streets, but there were still old West sheriffs. And to do that, but also to write a novel with great social import about the way we're living now, starting with the idea of income inequality, which has reached levels that it hadn't reached since that last Gilded Age. And so, and then when, of course, the protests over Black Lives Matters erupted in the United States, and just general, the sense of social unrest we have, it felt like this time I was writing about these characters, Gig and Rye, and the people that they come in contact with, that they were living a sort of echo of the world that we live in now. And so I felt like I got to write historical fiction that very much was as relevant today as it would have been then.
Now, the novel must have been done and edited by the time, well, certainly by the time Black Lives Matter and the latest unrest has unfolded.
Yeah, definitely it was. But, you know, I there have been marches for climate. There are students walking out of schools. There have been marches for gun safety. I watched the main characters in the novel, Rye Dolan is 17, and Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, a real historical figure, was 19 and pregnant, and an IWW organizer came to Spokane and almost single-handedly defeated this corrupt government and city government. And I was so amazed to see these, you know, to see a 19-year-old activist. And then I looked around me and the world is filled with 19-year-old activists walking out for climate, for sensible climate change policy, walking out of school because they're worn out from active shooter exercises. You know, I looked around and saw young people as fired up now as Elizabeth Gurley Flynn was in 1909. And then, yeah, the novel was done when the Black Lives Matters protests really roiled the streets. And again, it felt, you know, I suppose you write into them, no matter what you write, if you write science fiction, you're something set in the future, you write a dystopia, you're really writing about the time you're in. And I think that's the case with historical fiction too. I think you're always trying to balance the fealty of research with this idea that you're also trying to comment on the world you live in.
Well, and it was just so remarkable to pick this up and see all of these echoes. I mean, certainly the economic echoes, which hadn't really happened until, you know, the summer with the pandemic and the right. Rising unemployment. And, you know, it is always so interesting to see the world that the book is born into and how many echoes there are. And you've done this in the past. I mean, The Zero was a commentary on 9/11. And it does seem like most of your novels are in reaction or in commenting to something that's happening in the real world, no matter how far away you try to get from it in time. There it is.
Yeah, I my training was as a journalist, and I think I always joke that a novel is the worst possible place to break news, because by the time you finish it, it comes out 9 months or a year after you finished it, and people might read it 10 years later. So it can't be only of that moment, but I very much am still driven by the desire to reflect on what's happening around me. So during the financial crisis of 2008, when I wrote The Financial Lives of the Poets, I felt like I was sticking my head out of car windows as we went off the road. and this felt very much, I've been bothered by income inequality for the last decade and watching it get worse and worse over time. And then, yes, when the pandemic came, to be writing about the early 20th century and then have, you know, something like a pandemic, which, you know, there was the Russian flu of the 1890s and of course the Spanish flu of 1918. And so the characters that I'm writing about lived in that world. And it's almost as if the world comes up to meet the fiction that you're writing. And yet I also think a book can't only do that. It really has to be, you have to be gripped by those characters and by that world. And for me, that's, I don't think I could finish a novel if it was only a disguised op-ed article. You know? Right. I think in the end, the characters have to live for you as the writer in a way that even if it didn't comment on the times now, it would still resonate because that's what fiction does.
Right. So what was the thing that pulled you into this? Was it one of the characters? Was it the setting? What was that initial kernel that you captured?
For me, it's always four or five seemingly unrelated things that I always think of the way snowflakes supposedly combine on their way down. I use so many writing metaphors that probably have no basis in reality. I don't know if snowflakes even really do that, but I've heard they sort of cohere as they fall into bigger flakes. And for me, I'll have these things falling out of my writing journal, out of my mind. I had a note to write a book about Elizabeth Gurley Flynn and this period forever. And because I was just so interested in it, I was so interested in the true story. And so I had done some of that research. I also collect old postcards, and I had several old postcards that I would just find myself staring at, including one from 1911 in downtown Spokane with these packed streets and horses and streetcars, and it looks like New York. And you're staring at that in your sort of sleepier hometown thinking, what's going on down there? And then I would look closely at all the people on the street, and there was this one woman wearing white walking across the street. And then there was a man walking down the side street, and I would just stare at them and think, what are they doing? And it's almost that kind of meditation. And the other snowflakes that were falling, I really wanted to write something that felt Western to me. I wanted something with great action. I wanted to write about voices at the moment of their death. I've seen a writer do that, and I thought that would be an interesting adventure. So I have all these sort of parallel desires that at the time kind of cohere into, you know, and then it becomes a question of voice. Can I hear the sound of the book? And the more I researched 1909 and those early periods and read, you know, about Bindlestiffs and Pinkertons, and the more I just became engaged by that language. And again, to go back to the metaphor of the musician, I wanted to play those notes. And so, you know, you write a sentence that they woke on a ball field, bums, tramps, hobos, stiffs, and you just love the sound of that. And it sort of proceeds from those impulses. And really, I think those and maybe the political desire to reflect income inequality. There also for me was a bit of family in this one. Both of my grandfathers were itinerant workers in the 1930s. So a generation later than the characters here. But my grandpa Jess, who I'm named after, used to tell me these stories about jumping on trains in Kansas and the Dakotas and looking for work. And it's how he found Spokane, was arriving as a hobo on a train. My other grandfather, Ralph, was an Okie who worked in the fields of California and was killed by a falling crane. And so it also was a kind of origin story of my working class family, you know, and the belief that we had in collective labor, in the idea that a union was how you somehow achieved the middle class.
God, there's so much in there to unpack. First of all, I love the postcards, because I was thinking that writing a novel like this would probably require just a lot of pictures and photographs and postcards around your office, because you'd really have to get a sense of, you know, every scene. Well, what are they wearing, and who's driving by, and what do the storefronts look like? And you can't take anything for granted because everything's totally different. So relying on pictorial evidence seems even more important in a novel like this than it would in another novel.
And it's almost like science fiction. You have to explain to people the rules of a totally different world.
Yeah, you know? Right.
There are two suns, and gravity doesn't work here. And it didn't have those qualities. And I immersed myself in research. I read so many books and newspapers and would just pore over newspapers. And because small details, someone needs to buy a shirt. How much is a shirt? Where do you get it? Do you take the streetcar? Do you walk? Where someone has to go from Spokane to Wallace, Idaho. What time are those trains? You know, you do all of that research, but there's something about those postcards, the sepia quality of them. And almost all of them had writing on the back. Was one that was something like, arrived yesterday, haven't found Joe, more to come. And I'm like, who's Joe? I'll never know. It's just this note on the back of a postcard. So there's something almost impressionistic about those postcards that I found myself staring at. And for a fiction writer, they are almost as valuable as the newspaper microfilm that I spent days and days poring over, just because of their evocative quality. You want to create that same feeling of looking at those postcards and having them come alive.
Well, I did read that you were doing a lot of this research literally in the library and literally on microfiche, which is fantastic, because I feel like nowadays everybody's on Google all the time on newspapers.com. But there's something so perfect about, you know, pulling up the old microfiche. And I didn't even know libraries still had the machines. That's great.
I went to a couple of university libraries, because some of these newspapers don't exist. I mean, I could always find the daily newspapers, the Spokesman Review and the Spokane Daily Chronicle. But then newspapers, there were so many. So if something happened in Spokane, there were five newspapers you could choose from, including the Spokane Press, which went out of business not long after the events of my novel. And I found their old records in a university library, and so visited that one. There was a labor newspaper. There was a populist newspaper. And I could sort of triangulate events, because it was interesting to see how the establishment newspapers covered these events. They were so invested in the boosterism of the time that I often got realer details from some of these more marginal newspapers. And then you get just wonderful things like the listings of vaudeville shows. And I had the strangest moment. So I would be in these libraries, bent over reading this stuff and, you know, writing notes and taking photos from the microfiche and microfilm. And then I was jotting down various shows from these vaudeville theaters that were, Spokane at the time was one of the national centers that had the largest theater stage in the country. And this was the place next to San Francisco. This was the only great West Coast place for these entertainers to go. And as I'm writing these notes, I write down, Ursula the Great sings with a live cougar. And later, as I was going through my notes, I couldn't remember if I had read about her or invented her. And I'd written such copious notes about her show. And then I read something that would never have been in there, that meat is sewn into her corset to feed the cougar so that it doesn't attack her when she takes her corset off. And I went back to the library, and I realized that in my sort of frenzy of research, my imagination had kicked in, and I had invented this vaudeville act that then became a major part of the novel. And I love when that happens. I love, as a novelist, when you're so engaged by the research that, you know, without noticing it, you have conjured up a character that seems to you every bit as real as the ones you found in your research.
Well, and there were so many times in this book that something would happen. I'm like, oh, how are they going to get out of this one? And then, well, of course, there's meat sewn into her corset. You're so good at that. I mean, you have always talked about the need for surprising inevitability. You're just the very definition of that in your writing, because it's hard for me to read a book as, you know, doing the show and as a writer to not try and figure out how they're doing this, as opposed to just sitting back and enjoying the story. And in this novel, I couldn't help it. I just sat back and enjoyed the ride, because every time I'm like, oh, they're not going to get out of this one. You know, how are they going to? And you do it every time. I mean, every scene is full of surprising inevitability that leads to a whole novel that does that. And so as I'm thinking of you sitting here, you know, discovering Ursula the Great and her cougar, and then your own mind just going to, well, how does that work? How does she get out of this cage? You know, that's great.
Yeah, it is a little bit of a description of what the novelist does. You know, you imagine something and then you have to somehow make it possible. You know, how would you keep from being attacked by the cougar? So right. I think right. That's what we're doing all day, is trying to figure out how to keep the cougar from eating us.
Right. You also say that you often pose a question to yourself for a novel that you want answered for yourself. And I don't know if this novel had one of those as well, if you set out to answer a question for yourself.
Yeah, it's funny. Because I think it becomes a question that you meditate over, that you pose, that you explore, but you might not find the answer for it. And, you know, for this one, the novel basically takes place in this 1909-1910 period, but it's foreshadowed and post-shadowed by scenes in 1864 and 1964. And so the novel has a kind of 100-year scope, a nod to one of my favorite novels, 100 Years of Solitude. But in that very first section, that 1864 section, there's a character named the Kid who, in really dramatic moment, realizes that we just want to be seen in the world. And that question of wanting to be seen in the world, of wanting to be noticed and acknowledged and your to have your humanity respected really connects with Rye in a moment that he has in a millionaire's library, when he weeps at the idea that most people will never experience the wealth that he suddenly has found himself in. And I think that moment, that question of how we don't see the people who are below us on the ladder so often, was the question that I posed, that I wanted to follow through with this book. How, you know, my grandfathers were basically homeless. And in so many cities now, we cross the street to avoid the homeless. We think of the homeless as a problem. We take away their humanity in a way that is, you know, for our own comfort and safety, but is dehumanizing even us. And so I think that was the question I really wanted to pose. And what the Cold Millions refers to is, you know, people and struggling and who we either choose to see or not see. And for me, Gig and Rye and so many of the characters in this book, Jules and Gemma, and they were people that I just wanted to stop and see.
To that point, there were so many of these great, I'm calling them pull-out chapters, and I don't know how to refer to them, but they're, you know, you can kind of step out of the time of the novel and spend a little bit of time on somebody's backstory, Jules' backstory or Gemma's backstory, and really get to know them, as you say, really get to see them and really get to see where they came from and how, you know, how their characters evolved. And that's something that A Burning, I think, is the most recent novel that I saw do that to great effect also. And I think it's a really brilliant way to structure a book to be able to kind of be in the flow of narrative time and then just be able to step out for a second and get some more information on these characters. How did that kind of come about?
Such great observations, Marie. This is my first interview for this book, and it's so thrilling to see somebody read the book that you intended to write. So thank you. I did this also in Beautiful Ruins. I found myself wanting to tell a story not just with the depth of the interiority that a novel provides you, but with the kind of breadth as well, to tell the story across a vaster panorama than just, this is Dave, we're going to follow Dave through 300 pages while he decides whether or not to marry Belinda. You know, I just wanted it to be a vaster world. I just read, I've been reading this writer, Olga Tokarczuk, who I've been talking about for quite a while. And in her book, Flights, and in her Nobel Prize speech, she talks about the fourth person. We write in the first person or the third person. And she dreams of a sort of a more expansive voice. And I think that was the pull for me, was this, I wanted, you know, looking at that postcard, I wasn't looking at one person. I was looking at all of these people. And I wanted to try to capture the sort of crowdedness of the world. And so that And honestly, those pieces were the most fun to write. They were, you know, once I decide I'm going to write Ursula the Great's point of view, and she says, a woman owns nothing in this world, their memories. Mm-hmm. And that's the first words out of her mouth. I'm just like, what does that mean? Who are you? Where did you come up with that? And then she tells me she's not the first Ursula. And it's, I can get a kind of claustrophobia when I'm writing fiction, especially, you know, just tired of the world I'm in, tired of the voice I'm writing, and tired of the characters. And it's another way for me to play, you know, to all of a sudden tell the story of a 18-year-old outlaw who steals a fairy, you know, and and to be able to just, but to have those things contribute hopefully to a larger, more panoramic, more interesting version of the world. I've also seen this effect, I think, because we are so flooded with social media, with the first person. I did this, here's where I went on my vacation, here are pictures of me looking handsome. And it's another kind of claustrophobia I find myself. I want us to be collective. I want us to solve some of the world's problems as a collective, not as individuals. And the novel has a much longer history, at least in the American version of it, as an individualistic kind of storytelling device. But I'll read something like Richard Powers' Overstory, and I'll think, this is a collective novel. And so it's something I find myself more interested in reading and more interested in writing.
I should also point out that the voice of this novel is so unique. You know, the language into and of itself, as you say, like back in the early 1900s, the nouns were different.
One of my favorite words, I was researching this character, Del Delvaux, and I was reading that when people had a bad feeling or were depressed, they would call it the morbs. And I loved that. And Ciel comes on the stage by saying, Spokane gave me the morbs. And I so loved that old arcane language, the morbs, this morbid feeling that comes over you, that it almost propelled that entire chapter.
I'll bet, because I was... Well, I had to look that word up, but because I wasn't familiar with it myself. But, you know, just to walk around, it must be super jarring to leave your office with this heady other language and then, you know, enter the 21st century world with, as you say, all of the social media stuff. I mean, it seems like you'd be so immersed in this. And I know you work on several things at the same time and you have short stories going while you have novels going. But this felt so like you'd have to be in it and really in it for, you know, the duration of it. But hats off to be able to switch.
I live in a city that is so full of turn of the century, turn of the 20th century architecture. I live in a 1907 house. All of my neighbors live in 1907, 1908 houses. The bridges that I cross, this, I felt often like I was, not like I was leaving the world, but like that world existed and I didn't always see it. And, you know, Spokane is very much still a brick and railroad city. There's still train tracks running right through downtown that ascends almost through the city. They're above many of the buildings because Spokane's down in a valley. And of course, train tracks can't go up and downhill. They have to have a gradual incline and decline. And so over the Spokane River is this huge railroad bridge that I don't know how many times a day trains go across. And so it was, I had that great benefit of leaving and walking along the Spokane River along the same trails that my characters would have taken 110 years earlier. And, you know, I won't give too much of the plot away, but there's someone who's shot through a window, which really happened. Many of the events in the novel really happened. And his house is exactly the same. I walked down there and it's still this old clapboard house with a front porch, and there's the window he was shot through. And so it was very much a kind of meditative research to go pace around and walk through the neighborhoods of these mining magnates. Many of those homes now turned into apartment buildings because they're so massive. Or to walk through the neighborhoods of restaurants. One of my good friends owns an old flop house building that was, you know, SRO rooms for single minors all the way through the 1980s until he got it, I think, in the 90s and turned it into, you know, now it's a yoga studio and a group hub. But history feels really present and close, and in much the same way that the issues felt familiar, the places and the locations in that world felt just right at my fingertips.
I can relate to that because I grew up in Walla Walla, which is Spokane's kind of ugly stepsister or something. But
Spokane is an ugly stepsister, so I'm not of Seattle, so I'm not. I think there's a bunch of us in Washington.
But yeah, it does have that feel. It does have that feel.
Yeah, you know. Yeah, that those late 19th century, early 20th century downtowns in Eastern Washington they're still there, or else the town is gone. You know, I always think Spokane was lucky to not have any money in the 70s and 80s for a bad remodel. You know, when you buy that house and someone's put in like a coral colored kitchen and, you know, light blue shag carpet, there was no money in Spokane for that. So our Victorians are still Victorians, and our Queen Anne's are still Queen Anne's. And for a novelist, that was a real fortunate thing.
Absolutely. I also love how you talk about the shape of a story instead of the plot of a story, how a story has a certain shape to you. And War and Peace is sort of subtext that runs through this novel. The brothers are sort of sharing this book back and forth, and it kind of becomes a little bit of a symbol. And I was wondering if, I mean, I'm not terribly familiar with War and Peace, so I'm out of my depth here, but was the novel, did you kind of do an organizing principle based on other work that you could put in very subtly to give the book shape? Or tell me about the shape of this book for you.
I did. The shape for me worked on a couple of levels. Those interluding chapters we talked about, I thought of them as undercurrents. And so you have the main current of the novel, which is the third person story of Rye, and to a lesser extent, Gig, and the people that they meet, primarily Ursula the Great and Elizabeth Gurley Flynn. And that's the sort of main channel of the river. And then I kept imagining these undercurrents or small tributaries coming into them. And those are the other personal stories that come in. And so the first shape I had was of this river moving inexorably toward the ocean. We know exactly where it's going. Spokane's river flows into the Columbia, which then of course flows into the ocean. But it's a pretty small river in length, but it has a vast amount of water, huge churning waterfalls, especially in the spring. And so I imagine the novel almost taking that shape, flowing out of this lake and then over these falls, and the falls representing sort of the climax of the novel, and then the epilogue basically taking us to the river. So that was the first shape that I envisioned, and I love using that in my mind. And so you'll get three or four chapters of the main river, and then you'll get one of these tributaries or undercurrents coming into it. Another astute observation about War and Peace, because the novel has the same structure, four sections followed by an epilogue, which is a slight structural nod to War and Peace. And that book becomes important. Gig has collected what he thinks is two of the five sections, because he's actually reading a version from Tolstoy's collected 1903 works, which is splits War and Peace into five pieces. And he has collected two of them, and enough to pronounce it the greatest work of literature and history, which was sort of a joke almost at myself, because as someone who's self-taught, as an autodidact without a great literary education, I don't have an MFA, and I think my real college degree is even suspect. I love those self-taught people who, like I am, can pronounce something that they've only read 40% of the greatest work of literature and known to man. But it becomes a symbol of their aspiration. And, you know, I think in many ways, the most transcendent scenes in the book take place in libraries for Rye. This is the place where he imagines he can rise. And for me, there are two, you know, again, coming from a working class family, the first college graduate in my family, both of my fathers, but my father and my grandfather were dropouts who, you know, were laborers. for me to aspire to improve myself, the two paths, my dad was a union officer, and so labor is one of them, and the other one is education and books and reading, and that was really the path for me. And so having Gig and Rai share War and Peace and this desire to that worked both thematically and structurally for me. And then, of course, War and Peace is about the effect of history on individuals, which is really the story of Gig and Rai also, how they get caught up in this current of history and pulled along for a while until, as Rai says, the parade moves on and, you know, you're left standing on the sidewalk. And this is their moment sort of in the current of history.
I love this imagery of you thinking of things as shapes. I mean, even your characters, I think you often think of as shapes. There's a character in here described as a wheat stalk. Yeah. You have other characters described as martini glasses. You know, it's a nice way to sort of visually see your work and visually see your characters that seems true. And you can immediately transfer that image into the reader's head too.
And I started thinking, I mean, I did not invent it, of course. A lot of writers, I think, refer to shape. But for me, it was helpful to, we're all in those moments when we're trying to figure out what happens. What happens? You know, what happens next? And people, you know, my novels tend to be pretty full of action and event, but I almost never think of them as plot. I never think what has to happen. What, you know, I really think of it more as a shape, as following through to some point. And I think that I like that because sometimes when I am thinking in terms of plot, then I'll end up with these really binary questions, these toggle switches. Well, does he marry her or not marry her? Yes or no?
You know, right.
And I don't like that. It doesn't help me with that, with the thing you mentioned before, the inevitability. You know, I want this person to be pulled toward decisions. And then I can do all sorts of things. But if there's some drive, something pulling them or pushing them externally towards something, it feels better than just that situation where you're sort of waiting for your characters to act and create some motion in the novel. Having them pushed and pulled by the forces of their own desire or the desires of other people feels like an easier way to sort of maintain that idea of shape.
And yet there's so much action in the book, you know, so you get it in there, but maybe by coming at it in a more organic, true to the person's authenticity way, where you're not thinking about plot and toggle shifts, it just naturally comes out, you know, there just naturally is a lot of action.
I think it's another thing about being a newspaper reporter is often in fiction, we don't feel like we can be audacious enough to have somebody have a gun or do something drastic. And, you know, in my 7 years as a newspaper reporter, I don't know how many murders I covered. It's got to be in the certainly more than 50, and a mass shooting and cults and shootouts in the mountains and corruption. And, you know, you find yourself seeing that these things happen. And I always think I'm writing a novel because it's an extraordinary story, not because, and there are novelists who write ordinary stories beautifully. I find myself drawn to extraordinary stories. And so having things happen seems a sort of natural outcome of writing a novel to me. You know, I can't imagine, I mean, I can always imagine a world where in which drastic things happen. And I like to write those. I like to read them.
Well, and to your point about, you know, feeling a little bit nervous about guns coming out, it's such an American story. And you can really put our current, as we were talking about earlier, you can really put our current context in time of this is the American story, that guns are such an essential part of this, that if this book took place in Italy, this wouldn't be the same story, you know, that this is who we are. This is what we're built on, this economic disparity, this gun happy culture. You can just see all of it.
In the West, just the basic nature of Spokane, which is an Indian word, it's the name of the tribe that lived here, Children of the Sun. And this is a city named for the people who were driven from it. Just the very nature of the place we live in. And its origin story is army colonel riding down the river valley, punishing tribes that were rebelling against settlers by hanging any Indian chiefs or braves who came in and shooting 800 horses. And so the very birth of these Western cities is predicated by violence. And to this day, I mean, I think, you know, and it's true of the East as well. They might be four or five generations further removed, but, you know, most of the places in the West that honor tribes with their names, you have to ask yourself, they're living in land that those people were driven from, were forcibly driven from. And so I think it does underlie everything, you know, that you start to tell, every story that you start to tell, and especially one that is concerned with inequality and with granting those rights to all people. You have to start in that. And I think that's what drew me to a Western too, is to trace that, those moments back to their origin.
Well, and to go back to one of your earlier points about one of the snowflakes that was coming down, of talking about men at the end of their lives, people at the end of their lives, and slowing that time period down, which is another way that you played so beautifully with narrative time. You've got a great craft lecture. I just wanted to highlight for people that want to look it up with Hugo House a couple of years back on narrative time. But those moments of men at the end of their lives and men reflecting back on what it means to die, what they wanted their legacy to be, what they reflect on at the very end, you know, what they're able to hold on to and what they have to let go of. All of those moments are kind of reflective in the bigger American story, as you say. You know, it's these microscopic moments on the individual level really mirror the bigger American story. Those were so beautiful too.
Thank you. Yeah, it's I hope so. As I was walking around the city and thinking about, you know, all these old buildings and everything, I thought every one of my characters is gone. You know, yeah, if they existed, right, they're now ghosts. And that, and just that desire to have them tell me what it was like in those last moments, what profound thoughts crashed through their minds, what mundane thoughts crashed through their minds. Were they fearful? Were they sorry? Was it regret? Was it, you know, I think sometimes about the brevity, just the furious finger snap of time that we're here and everything we do to try to avoid acknowledging that. And I loved writing those characters. I loved it as a kind of play too, you know, to picture each of those characters in their last moments. And some of them are important to the book, some of them are sort of side notes, but for each of them, it was another way to have them be seen, you know, to honor them a little bit. And again, and to think of them as this roiling undercurrent of a much larger river. And again, not to belabor cliched writing metaphors, but, you know, the idea of time in a river, which is one of the oldest writing ideas, I find myself more and more realizing that the subject of everything we write is time. How we use it, how we spend it, our time here, and especially when you write a historical novel. And it makes me want to have more scope in stories. I indulged probably the longest epilogue I've ever done because I just wanted to know what happened to these characters. Sometimes I think as authors, we can be so coy. You know, we end right as the couple makes eyes across the library and you just have to guess that they get together. And with this story, because I was writing these ghosts, I wanted to know how their lives turned out. I wanted to know what happened to them.
Was there one of them that gave you more difficulty? It's a mixture of real life characters populated with a lot of fictional characters around them. And I was wondering if any one of them was difficult to access for whatever reason, or how you dealt with somebody who was hard.
I think the hardest thing for me, there's a draft of this book a year ago in which Elizabeth Gurley Flynn is on the page for about three times as much time as in the final. Because it was a real historical figure, you want to give her her due. For those people who don't know, she has just an amazing story. Grew up in New York, the daughter of an Irish laborer and a mother who was really unbelievable in giving her daughters the idea that, you know, years before they would have the right to vote, that they should be empowered to live their lives and to, you know, work for things. And Elizabeth Gurley Flynn gets involved as a street speaker for labor and socialist causes as like a 14, 15 year old and becomes pretty famous early on. And that quality just was so interesting to me. So I almost wrote a biography where I wrote so much of Elizabeth Gurley Flynn. And then it was talking to my editor and realizing myself that the novel, again, had a much broader scope than that. And the one difficulty in some ways in writing a novel with real historical figures is that you can fall in love with them that way. You know, you can fall in love so much with the real parts of the story. And at some point when I'm writing anything that requires research, I have to fire the researcher. You know, the fiction department takes over and we have to lay off everybody in the research department and give them their walking papers. And that was the case here, especially because, you know, we could only handle so many street corner speeches. And so I think that was the hardest thing for me, was letting go of, you know, and it's one of the reasons, besides having a long epilogue, I have a pretty large set of acknowledgments, more than usual, because I really do want people to go read, you know, Elizabeth Gurley Flynn's autobiography or biographies of her or of other labor activists and suffragists of the time.
I have so many more questions and we're running out of time, but I wanted to throw in two more things that I think can be helpful for writers. One is, as you talk about being an autodidactic learner, do you feel like the readings that you do, it doesn't matter what you read, as long as you read broad and wide and deep? Or, you know, are there some essential readings that every writer should just have accomplished?
I think those things evolve. I think when I was younger, I remember the moment that I realized how underread I was, how unserved I had been by my education. And I began reading with frenzy and a fury as if I could catch up. I have several writer friends who laugh at my insecurity and say, you're the best read person we know. and I clung to that insecurity probably far longer than I needed to. And I'm a much more relaxed reader now, especially because new books are coming out all the time. And you're like, wait, I haven't heard of this person. You know, when did this get translated? Oh, no. You know, it piques the old panic. But no, I think we always should be pushing ourselves as a reader, looking to broaden our reading with diversity, with works in translation. And then we should remember the play rule too, where we should read things we love. You know, and I the one thing I don't feel bad about now is not finishing a book, putting a book down. Sometimes I'll think, oh, I love what this author's up to, and I'll put it down. And I even put down books I'm liking or enjoying. And sometimes books I'm loving, I start skimming because I can see, you know, the puppet strings or something. And so I do think I've stepped away from the guilt I used to feel, but I still try to read with that same enthusiastic frenzy of someone trying to catch up, trying in vain, because you can never catch up.
Right. And I also wanted to give a nod to your notebooks that you talk about a lot. So if listeners want to hear more about those, there's plenty of places they can find them out. But I was just wondering, you know, living through the world as we're living through it now, I assume you have your notebook for the work you're working on, which is, you know, notes you take about the work. But then do you have a separate notebook of just observations of, you know, Starbucks conversations you overhear or things that fill your creative well, you know, as a writer?
I the two journals I keep are more differentiated by their size. I have a pocket journal and then I have a bigger one, which tends to collect more literary thoughts, I suppose. The pocket journal often is to do, but depends which journal I'm carrying. They all flow together. In this office behind me, the top two shelves there are dedicated to old journals. And I also read my old journals, which I find so helpful. Great paths out of writing problems, admonitions, and encouragements that I gave to myself. I often find myself coming up on the same problems as a writer that I had before. And so going back to those journals and looking to see But yeah, I put bits of dialogue, little aphorisms that might occur to me. They flow back and forth between both journals. The bigger journal, though, is where I will often pause once a week and just write a longer note to myself. And I have to say, I sometimes imagine other people reading. So that it helps me to explain who this person was that I had lunch with and explain why this breakthrough in the novel meant something to me. And I don't imagine like it, you know, someone reading it for literary reasons, but it just helps me when I go back to it to have things in context and to explain to myself the world.
Right. Well, it kills me running out of time, but you have a wonderful website and you have a lot of events coming up, Zoom events. So there's, I was perusing the website yesterday and there's a lot coming up that people can tune into and join in, jesswalter.com. And God, this was just a huge pleasure. I just adored the book and I adore you. So this was a great compliment.
Well, it's so great to stay in touch after we worked together at Tin House. That was so fun.
It was super fun. The best. That's all the time we have for today. We'll be right back here with you next Wednesday morning. So until next time, thanks so much for joining us. Have a great day.